This is episode 20 of the Software Freedom Law Show for February 2nd, 2010. Hi, I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn, and this is the Software Freedom Law Show.
The freezing cold Software Freedom Law Show.
Well, the heaters make so much noise that we have to turn them off. And that's why we have to do it in my office now, because we can turn my heaters off independently. And yours, if we turn yours off, we turn the entire other side of the building, or other side of the floor off, and then everybody is affected.
But now I'm shivering over a cup of tea.
Do you want my coat?
No, it's okay.
Okay. I have coats.
This is a very scintillating beginning of our show.
So you were going to update people. There's more stuff happening with this Google book settlement thing.
Oh, yes. I did want to talk about that, but I thought maybe we should start talking about follow-up from the last show.
Okay, we can start there. And we'll have more stuff on the Google book settlement in the next segment.
Well, some people like when we have teasers. So,
okay, there
so
it is.
That's a teaser.
Okay. I didn't mean to do it, but I just forgot. I honestly just forgot what we were doing first, but now we're doing this first.
We're not usually so structured.
So, yeah, it's true enough. Well, this feedback, we did have many people say that they like the podcast, which is the first email I brought up here.
And I guess one thing we wanted to say was that this is sort of a topic that we'll be talking about. I think we did say last week that this was sort of the first introduction to the topic, but that we were going to keep talking about issues as they arose and get more in depth on legal issues and things like that.
So are you saying, as a producer loves to say, you'll keep an eye on that one?
And Bradley is referring to Dan Lynch, our producer or volunteer producer, who also is the host of Linux Outlaws.
And he says after every story that he's going to keep an eye on that one.
So we will be keeping an eye on it.
Well, yeah, and we did get some. The one comment we got back that was asking for more was that we didn't cover some of the detailed legal issues. We have talked about those in the past regarding mm-hmm. the FCC and so forth, but it seems, and since people were asking for it, reasonable for us to do an update on that. So we're preparing a show for the future to cover that.
Show of the future.
We're not the show of the future. That's definitely not true.
I'm a little loopy today.
I mean, everybody else has video feeds now, so, and they do live recordings, and so we're definitely.
Well, that'd be really bad because I have a head cold, and which is part of why I'm a little loopy, and if we had video, then everyone would see.
Yeah, I don't think there's really a necessity for maybe I'm like those people who were in radio before there was TV and saying that. Oh, radio will be here forever or whatever. But I don't know how necessary it is to have feeds of people talking about stuff, video feeds, which is what a lot of podcasts do now. And
I think it really depends on how you learn and how you hear, because I actually hear better when I see people talking. Like, I understand what people are saying better when I can see their lips move. It doesn't make any sense. I don't know why. It's not like I have any problem with my hearing. I just process it better when I can see somebody. But that said, I wouldn't want us to go with video, so.
Well, Monday night you can see the Linux Outlaws live show, so.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they do the live show.
You know, that sounds interesting.
Oh, okay. Well, we're not going to do one of those.
Good.
I don't want to do a live show or a video feed. So we are kind of living in the past.
We aren't the show of the future, but we'll have another show in the future that will talk about those issues.
Every 2 weeks we have a show in the future. But then it's in the present, and then it becomes in the past.
You're blowing my mind.
We did kind of fail to mention that there was a new free runner out when we talked about this in the last show, and somebody wrote in to say that the A7 model of the free runner is still on sale and still available. So there is somewhat of a future for the free runner.
Right, and that model doesn't have the buzzing problem that I had with my old model. So I'm actually tempted to go buy one now and try it out.
Yeah, we had actually a pretty. I want to jump into this because it's an orthogonal point, but it's related. Evan, actually, of Identica fame, brought up the issue that that there are these multiple projects trying to push forward freedom on the mobile space. And I had somewhat of a disagreement with that. I think that it is useful to have multiple free software projects trying to push forward on an issue that's trying to solve the same issue, because their different approaches are good and there are ideas that are useful. I compared it to the distributed version control space, where we had multiple version distributed version control systems under development that have both pushed each other forward. Right. And they, it was a new idea of doing version control and having multiple people researching through code how to get that done, I think was useful. And the argument back was, well, that's actually bad that there's all these different systems that you have to convert mm-hmm. between them and so forth. But it doesn't bother me that much. There's probably one or two more than there should be, but having two or three, I think, is okay. I don't think it's a bad thing. Git appears to be gaining the most mm-hmm. mind share in that space, and maybe it will be the default one in the future. But it doesn't bother me that there's
lots. I mean, it's a little different in the phone space, but I don't...
Well, I think the analogy fits. There are multiple projects doing very similar things. I think the place where maybe it's different is with the hardware. Is that what
Well,
you're
that's
thinking?
What I mean, yeah.
And what are your thoughts on that, of the differences in the hardware?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I just think it's tough to get momentum because you do have several projects that are focused on the same hardware. So it's more than just the one level.
But that's not totally true. Now there is the group that wants to get a GNU/Linux type system mm-hmm. on the
that's sort of
HTC
what I'm thinking
devices.
About. Yeah.
I actually said on the last show that I don't think that's a good way to proceed necessarily. Of course, I'm happy for any hacker to work on whatever project interests them if it's free software. But on the other hand, it's not a project I would put my mind behind because I just don't think that's useful. But having the Nokia guys working on a GNU/Linux type platform for the N900 and having and the MER project, which I forgot to mention last time as well, which is trying to do the fully free software, basically what we're trying to do in Replicant for Android, they're trying to do in MER mm-hmm. for the Nokia phones. So I think that's useful to have in parallel. I've actually been thinking a lot. It's very similar to the way the PC space was in the late 80s and early 90s, where there was lots of incompatible hardware, and you just had to try to support as much as you could, and you had to put mindshare behind different types of components because there was this competing thing, the whole IDE versus SCSI stuff and all that sort of thing, where there were these multiple things. And that SCSI stuff, that only disappeared in recent years when Serial ITA took over. And there were still the SCSI subsystem separate from the IDE subsystem and those sorts of things. So we've had similar problems on PC hardware. I know the analogy is not perfect, but we do have these different phone platforms and different operating systems targeting them, and trying to free as many as we can, I think, is a good idea because we don't know which one is necessarily going to succeed.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely true.
And so we want to make sure we're as free on all platforms. And I think that, mm-hmm. so for example, if we took it the other way and said, well, let's try to port Android/Linux over to the Nokia devices, I mean, that's probably such a pain to try to do that it wouldn't be worth it. And we might as well have something like the MER project trying to free that. So
I don't know. I haven't followed the port of Android to FreeRunner and whether that's something that's being used for the current model.
Well, I think the FreeRunner doesn't.
But there's, I mean, I guess there are so many phones mm-hmm. bouncing around. I guess that's my...
Yeah, and this is where I make the PC analogy again, right? The most number of people in the world, to non-free software people, mm-hmm. are going to have an Android-based device, if you want to just count. iPhone and Android are going to be the two big competitors against Blackberries, basically. And the funny thing is, if you add iPhone, there was this report.
I was wondering if you were going to mention that.
I hadn't even thought about it before our last show, but someone on Identica, and I'll put in the show notes who it was because I don't remember and I don't want to try to guess who it was, linked to this article about what market share various different so-called smartphones, I hate that term, but that's the term that they use, had in the market. And of course, Research in Motion, which makes the BlackBerry, is some huge percentage of the market, and the other ones added together don't even make up to that.
I think wasn't the statistic that sort of called your attention to it something like Android adoption increases by 300% or right. something like that?
Of course, it was from a small number to another small number, and that was a big jump because the numbers were small.
Yeah.
But the iPhone, the good thing for us is that is for all the hype that the iPhone gets, it's nothing compared to the stodgy old BlackBerry, which I think we can catch up with on the free software space pretty quickly. So I'm not so worried, really, about free software adoption, but we have to focus on the hardware people have. Now, if somebody wants to try to make one of these free software systems run on a BlackBerry, that would be amazing. I don't think it might not be possible, but But if it were possible, that would be the way to go, because that's the hardware most people have. But we should be. But if we can't do that, then we should target the hardware people have. I don't think people are going to be able to make free software for the iPhone, so the next option is the Android models.
I think that's right. I mean, and also BlackBerry usage tends to be very corporate-based, and it tends to be corporate policy. So you're getting the situation where I think people are having two phones for themselves because they have one given to them by their company and one for their own use.
Does that happen a lot?
I've been seeing it often. Well, having used to be a law firm lawyer and hang out with those types for now and again. And that is what I've been seeing, because people really want their new toy. You know, they want their own, you know, they want their iPhone, or they want their G1. They want something that, separate from what the law firm will provide them.
Yeah, as I said in the last show, most of my phones have been owned by my employers. And my employers for the past, 11 years have been free software nonprofits.
So. You've been lucky with your employers in that regard.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Right? Yeah, of course, FSF owned a phone that was proprietary software, so I don't know if I should say that. But of course,
that was a while ago. Yeah,
back in the early 2000s.
Yeah, we won't comment on the unfortunately named Apple device, but for some reason, just sitting here and talking about iPhones, I really wanted to refer to it. It could be my loopiness.
It's the same old proprietariness we have from Apple.
I agree. And actually, I think in a way it's useful, because it really does squarely position Apple and its products in an old camp, in an old DRM governed model that, a lot of people are fed up with and not willing to tolerate. It's just, I think this idea of Apple being so cool and different and something that people want to use is really eroding.
I was just thinking they are different now, because I think most people have decided they don't want DRM, and now they're being different. They're saying, we're going to give you DRM again. Because Apple had actually backed down somewhat on DRM, and now they're back on it full
swing
again.
Yeah, I think that's right. But, they only backed down on it because there was so much consumer pressure.
Yeah, and in that regard, I think the time is now for people to start paying attention again, if they aren't already, to the Defective by Design campaign. Mm-hmm. And they've got a petition, which we know will do no good to influence Apple, but the idea of having lots of people on the internet signing a petition that says that they don't support what Apple's doing is a good thing, just to show numbers that there are lots of people that don't agree with Apple. The goal of signing a petition like that is not to actually convince Apple, because you can't change the mind of a company that's that unfriendly, but showing the rest of the world that there are this many people that
and
are
also
bothered by what Apple's doing.
Just restarting the conversation about DRM, mm-hmm. because I think that we talked about it a lot a few years ago, and sort of got, in a way, mass consensus about what we as consumers were willing to put up with and what we weren't. And that's what we saw in the changed iTunes policy. And that was in part by supporting companies like eMusic and supporting non-DRM'd hardware and software. And, I think we can do that again. But the conversation needs to be restarted, and the petition is the first important step in that, I think.
Right, and now we're going into a new space, which is the area of books. But I think we will win on books just like we won on music, because no one wants to tolerate it. It's too annoying. There's this whole thing with things like 1984 being taken back by Amazon because they lost the rights to it. These things consumers will not put up with in mass, and you're messing with librarians too. And there's one thing I've learned is you never mess with librarians about access to information. There's some great
librarian association and individual librarians writing about these issues now.
Yeah, we should mention one of the fans of our shows, DBS, is a librarian and a software hacker as well, and has written some about this issue, and lots of librarians have talked about the issue of DRM, because it makes their jobs harder. Their goal is to help people find and understand and digest information that's available to them. Well, DRM just gets in their way.
Yeah.
So I'm not that way. I think we're going to beat DRM, but we're not going to beat it by standing still. We're going to have to pay attention to it, do things like sign the position, support Defective by Design. I really wonder
if the new Apple product is a step back, or if it's just really going to help us to move forward that much faster.
I just don't know what the Apple product's for. That's what most technologists have been saying, and everybody's been answering that.
That's what consumer reviews have been saying as well. How is this product so different?
Consumer reviews are saying, well, the people writing these reviews aren't the people this is targeted at. Who is it targeted at? Who wants it?
That's a really good question, because friends of mine who just for some reason love Apple, and despite the number of arguments and discussions that I've had with them over the past few years, the people who love Apple will basically watch those, you know, watch the Apple announcements, and whatever it is that's released, they'll want it. And they'll, you know, they'll write about it immediately and go on and on about how they want it. But those people now say, why would I want that? I don't want that. That's not, you know, oh, maybe I'll buy a new laptop, but I have no desire to have, or a new, you know, a new phone, but I have no desire to have that piece of hardware. So it's really interesting. They don't want it. I don't know. I wonder who it is targeting. Why are you laughing?
My favorite comment about the iPad was, it was cool because it didn't even mention the iPad, but PR Cutler on Identica, who's works on the GNOME project and some other free software things he does, he said, if you think AT&T G3 service is slow now, just wait. That's all he said. And I thought it was perfect because it's just so classic that's basically what it's saying, is it's not something that people can use. It's going to cause trouble. There's been all these stories. You see these, somebody was telling me about these stories of they're trying not to sell iPhones in New York City because the network, AT&T networks,
are you serious? Overrun.
Yeah. So they're slowing down the number of iPhones available in the New York market
because the
G3 service can't take it. I mean, the 3G rather service can't take it. And it's just, I mean, New York City is a weird market in that regard.
It really
there's
is.
So many people, but
yeah.
But still, it's just.
But you see so many iPhones every day. On the subway.
Yeah, I don't. I try not to. I see people with iPhones, and I
you I avert try, your eyes.
I move away from them. I don't sit next to them
on the subway.
No. Proprietary phones like that.
I always sit next to people who have you know, proprietary equipment generally, because I also, you know, including like the Kindles in this too. But I really like to sit next to them because I want to see what they're, you know, not only what it looks like, you know, and how they're using it, but what they're, you know, like what content they're actually looking at on that, like to see, you know, how exactly these people are using these devices and how it fits into their lives. Now, New Yorkers are probably not a good indication because we have a lot of time where we're doing nothing while we're traveling, which is different. Like we don't, you know, we're not driving, so we can focus on whatever we want while we're doing that. But, you know, during our commutes.
You know, I sat next to somebody on the subway about a year and a half ago who was actually had a GNU Linux box that he was doing it looked like a prep thing for a sysadmin class that he was taking in VirtualBox. So he was running Fedora, and he had what looked like it was VirtualBox with Debian running inside the VirtualBox, and it was like a pretty hardcore hacker.
Did you say anything? I mean, you kind of can't, can you? Because you've been looking over his shoulder.
Well, not many people will take out their laptops on the subway as it is. So he was drawing attention to himself just by having his laptop out.
Right.
Like, I never take my laptop out on the subway.
But sometimes when I see people with a t-shirt, you know, with a free software t-shirt, I smile at them, but it's always awkward.
Yeah. So bad.
They often leave early on the subway.
I always just thought it was cool to see somebody using free software on the subway.
Yeah.
Of course, I see lots of Android phones now. So
tons of Android phones.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
So we were talking about. So we should probably take a segment break.
Well, I'm wondering, did we go through all of the?
I think we covered. There were fewer emails than I thought there were, so I think we've covered them all.
I was congratulated. I was wondering if you were going to mention that.
Yeah, but I congratulated you last.
Oh, time. Did you? I thought we didn't mention it. Oh,
we mentioned it, didn't we?
I didn't.
We can mention it again that you were promoted. I'm almost sure we mentioned it.
Oh, if we did, I apologize. That's very.
It's okay. We can mention it again.
Egocentric. No, it's okay.
Yeah, but somebody congratulated you. That's why they congratulated you, because we mentioned it.
Oh, you're so right. Okay.
Karen's very proud of her promotion, and we're very proud of her, so we're going to mention it again.
Well, no, I mean, because I remember we talked about potentially mentioning what a general counsel does and why, what that role is. We were going to make that a segment, so I thought maybe you'd want to talk about it because we didn't talk about it. So I forgot that you had mentioned it.
But let's sequence things up. We've got lots of teasers here. We'll take a break. We'll come back and talk about the Google Book Summit, and then we'll come back and talk about what a general counsel does.
All right.
Okay. So there's an update, Karen, you have for us about the Google Book settlement. We've been doing some work on behalf of the Free Software Foundation regarding their objections, and there's a new thing happening with it, right?
Well, that's right. Well, we did have a show, or a portion of a show some time ago, where we talked about the Google Book settlement, and we talked about how the Free Software Foundation objected to the Google Book settlement.
And we'll link to that show in our show notes.
Excellent. And And what was so interesting about, or what I thought was so interesting about that objection is that we actually came at that objection from, and I say we because we, SFLC, helped the Free Software Foundation write their objection. Actually, the first objection, we actually wrote and submitted it. So it came from the Software Freedom Law Center on behalf of our clients. Festival chiming in.
Yeah, well, the thing was, I unmuted it to test the last segment to make sure the sound was okay, and then I forgot to remute it. So I apologize.
Well, and so the news that Bradley's referring to is that the Free Software Foundation filed a second objection. So in the time since we filed our first objection, the Google Book settlement was amended to address the flood of objections that they had gotten in on the first proposal. So so the second objection was submitted directly by the Free Software Foundation, but we assisted them again. So I say we loosely because sometimes lawyers, when they're working on behalf of clients, feel like they're we feel like we're really a team and we feel like we're a part of the projects or clients that we're representing. Which when you're in a line of work like ours, it's really fun and great. So. Anyway, so that's why I said we, but really the Free Software Foundation filed it. and what I was about to say before Festival was that the first objection that we filed was completely from the opposite side of things than most of the other objections, which is that we were saying that the book settlement actually didn't make works available freely enough and didn't respect free licenses that users had chosen to publish their works. And the Free Software Foundation in particular, as an author of works that were freely licensed and works that were had their copyrights registered, were a part of the class of works that and plaintiffs that are included in the class action suit. So the Free Software Foundation basically objected, saying, you know, you're allowing Google to excerpt portions of the book, but not under the terms of the licenses that we allowed. So basically, we allowed a lot more freedom than what Google is exercising. And in fact, Google is frustrating our license because they're, for example, not publishing the entire license
or
along with
the transparent format and those sorts of things that FDL requires, for example.
Right. So this actually, the amended settlement tried to address some of these issues and included a provision that basically allows what they call the rights holder, or you know, the authors or whoever holds the copyright, to go and tell Google after, you know, afterwards, they can to say, well, actually, this work should be considered under a different license, a free license, and the Google Book settlement specifically mentions Creative Commons or a similar license. And basically it allows the right holders to indicate that there are different terms for free distribution, which is interesting, and it's a step in the right direction, but from the Free Software Foundation and our perspective, it's inadequate because basically it puts the burden on the rights holder, it puts the burden on the author of the work to say, you know, I distributed this work under a free license, you know, and now you have to respect it. It should be something that that Google or whoever is creating the database, when they, you know, when they include the work and they choose to include the work, they should, you know, on their own import those terms.
Yeah, it seems very unfair. And one of the arguments that Google has made in the press about this is that they're the only organization, that they have the resources to do this, and we're going to have a Library of Alexandria problem which seems a little bit stretched, because there's not like one library in the world like there was in those days. That it would be really problematic if we lost these works, and Google's doing a preservation project, and Google's the only one who has the resources, because they have so many more resources than, say, the Internet Archive or other nonprofits. So therefore, as a public service, they're doing this, and we should give them whatever they need to be able to do this great public service that they're going to do. So if their argument is we have the resources, that's why we should have special rights to do this and special permission to do this, then why don't they have the resources to check the license of each work and make sure they're doing it right?
As the FSF mentions in its letter, Google does have the burden under the amended agreement to indicate whether whether there's commercial use of a work or not. You know, that's, you know, that's something that Google is already doing, and it's not any more of a burden on them to monitor these licenses. So, you know, that's whereas there's an unacceptable burden on a rights holder to go and monitor, you know, every time there's a use and make sure that it's being used under the correct license, and to go and change it with the registry is that affirmative step. It's an unfair burden to put on the rights holder as opposed to on the book registry and on Google. So that's sort of the position. There are other changes too that to the book settlement that other people are objecting to as well. But one of the things that
most of those objections are probably related to their desire to have proprietariness control over the books.
I mean, some objections are the objections actually are limited.
So these are actually objections to objections, right?
Well, the new objections are you can only object now on the amendments.
Right. Yeah.
So that's why the FSF's objection is limited. But some of the changes that they made were positive steps based on the original objection. So, for example, they did take away the so-called most favored nation clause for Google. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's not other things they did based on the objections was they limited the scope of the class action so that it's no longer as international. So when you talked about the World Library idea, it's now limited to, I think, it's the United States, Canada, I think Australia and the UK as well.
Yeah, to be clear, I wasn't talking about that. I was quoting what Google representatives have said in the press about that.
No, I know.
I don't think that's actually what they're doing.
But that's a major change.
I think if they want that to happen, quite frankly, I don't see why Google should be doing this. The Internet Archive, for example, is trying to do these sorts of things. Why doesn't Google give a grant to the Internet Archive to do it and let it be done in a nonprofit way? I don't see why Google is so special.
It's a very strange way of getting at this result, and a lot of the critics have pointed to the fact that class action is really not the right way of handling this. Like,
oh, you mean class action by the copyright holders?
Yes. That it's a
I was
strange
of the whole problem of digitizing.
No, I know,
knowledge.
But a lot of people would say that this should be solved through legislation, and not through a class action where you had copyright holders sue and then have a negotiated settlement that applies to everyone. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of criticism about whether or not people can truly opt out, whether they'll be informed, things like that. Yeah, they did change the unclaimed works provision so that now the old agreement had the any amounts for unclaimed works go into support the general operation of the book registry, and now it's held for I think it's for 10 years or something like that, and if no one comes forward to claim that money, then it goes towards nonprofits that are either to support literacy or so those aren't real improvements, but I'm sort of inclined to agree with critics when they say this isn't the right way to solve this problem.
Yeah, the problem with taking this through a legislative angle in the United States is the legislative agenda in the United States right now is so filled with important issues that, I mean, they're totally unrelated to any stuff related to software freedom, that it's very difficult. And it's hard for me to say as a software freedom advocate that issues related to information freedom and software freedom should be on the front of our agenda right now on a national level. It's hard to say because there are so many
issues. We've got so many major problems.
Yeah, I mean, the United States is not in a good spot right now.
And we don't seem to have the, real ability to pass good to create and pass good legislation.
Oh, it's because we're completely corrupt.
It's probably not the best use of our show to have I don't think you won't hear me disagreeing. but basically we've seen a failure to get any major piece of legislation passed anyway. So
right, but if Google was truly a don't be evil type of company, they would say that what they should be doing is making philanthropic contributions to nonprofits that aren't known to be out there. I think the Internet Archive is a great example that want to do true good digital library archiving of important information historically and for the future.
I think the truth is that we're so far down this road now that I think we're probably going to have to live with with the result at this point.
And, I know we will. I'm
really glad actually that the Free Software Foundation has been a publisher of freely licensed books, because this was an issue that they raised that I think wasn't even on anyone's radar screen. And it really came at it from the other completely opposite direction than most of the other objections, that making sure that there are provisions that require respect of free licenses is so important. And will become increasingly important over time.
And well, I think the important thing to think about, and the reason we're talking about in this show, is there are a class of written works in a natural language, as a computer scientist would say, that are very similar to the issues of software freedom. In fact, they're directly related, because if you look back in the history of software freedom writing and issues about our cause, the idea of freely available documentation, freely available how-to works, freely available tutorials about how to do things with software are central to the advancement of free software. Because if you don't have good documentation, everyone knows using software is really difficult, and improving software is really difficult if it's not well documented. And documents obviously are written in a natural language, and they're often published as books. And that's where this issue relates so closely to software freedom, because what we have called in the software freedom world generally useful technical information, which is what a documentation for software is, those issues about GUTI, as we've often, GUTI abbreviated it, is the same as software freedom. Having the right to modify.
And you say
and
we,
them.
You don't really mean,
I mean
like
me
we
and the
generally.
FSF types.
You mean
me and
you
Stallman
and Stallman.
And Novalis. Novalis actually started
okay.
The whole sort of 2000-ish era FSF volunteers and types, we all started saying that.
In any event, you know, I know it's off topic for us, but I as a proponent of free culture licenses, you know, I think that this is important. And as the FSF says in its letter, those licenses were I don't want to misquote it. I have it in front of me. That the FDL, for example, helped to inspire those licenses. So you know, there is a connection, and you know. Because the books that will be covered in the book settlement are so broad and cover so many different topics, it's really important.
Yeah, I'm more because I am who I am. I'm more worried about the technical information and that sort of thing. The works of literature, while it's great if they're free, is in freedom, and I'm not opposed to it, and I think it's a good thing. I just don't. It doesn't impact the issues I'm most concerned about very much.
Right. Well, I just believe really strongly that if somebody, you know, licenses their work to promote freedom, that those licenses should be respected.
Oh, I agree with that completely.
And it's so essential that it should be built into the construct of something like the Google Book Settlement and anything else that deals with copyrighted works.
Yeah, I guess I feel this whole thing, I have this weird feeling of disgust right now, because I think basically what's happening is we're trying to get the best we can out of something that really shouldn't be done this way at all. The Google should not be in control of this process. And they are. And
but this is. I mean, this is what we talked about last time, and you know, we'll just have to see what winds up being the final deal. It's very interesting. We'll keep our eye on that.
So, Karen, we should find out from you what it is that your job entails, because I certainly...
Well, now I'm reluctant to talk about it.
Why
I'm
that?
Not really reluctant to talk about it. I just...
Why should you be reluctant? We need to know. We need to know these things. We need to know what the deal is with what you do.
Well, I actually just forgot that we had mentioned it last time, and that makes me...
Well, and we didn't have time last time. We actually talked about doing this as a segment last time, and we didn't have time to go into detail.
Well, that's why I thought we hadn't mentioned it, because we talked about a segment to sort of describe what general counsels do, generally counseling.
Yeah, so that's something of interest. I guess it's, we have to make the usual for-profit, non-profit distinction, because I would presume that the roles are somewhat different in a for-profit world than a non-profit, or are they
actually similar? They're pretty similar. I mean, you know, sometimes the title general counsel means the most senior, like the top lawyer in an organization, in a company or organization, but that's a little bit different here, where, you know, most of our organization is lawyers. So, for example, we have an executive director who's a lawyer. So that term, general counsel, is, you know, that meaning is not relevant here, because we have a different kind of organization. So sometimes that, you know, general counsel merely means, you know, in charge of all the legal matters that an organization will deal with. Now, when the whole organization, and then you have a CEO and a COO, and usually the primary concern of those companies or organizations is non-legal. But in our situation, where, you know, we're legally focused, so everything we do is legal related. But a general counsel does deal with all the internal legal you know, all of the legal problems that will arise within a company, and that's true here too. So, you know, I you know, general counsel at SVLC means handling all of our internal legal work.
So it's somewhat of a meta position, in a way, because you're handling the meta problem. Because a lot of the work that people do at SVLC is work for client, legal work for clients that are free software projects and free software nonprofits.
That's right.
But you're doing the meta work of the legal work for SVLC itself.
Right. And that includes, like, you know, governance issues and any conflicts issues or ethics issues and things like that that could arise. So, you know.
And now I can't ask you any details because you'll say it's a matter of attorney-client privilege, right?
I'd tell you, but I have to kill you.
Well, you don't have to kill me.
No, I'm just kidding. again, I'm loopy today.
Okay. So, can you give a hypothetical example that's nothing like what you do here that would help people understand? Is there some sort of hypothetical we can give them that won't?
Well, no. I mean, like, there are some concrete things that that I can give examples of that are true that I would. Well, I was going to say that is true for a general counsel at SVLC and true of a general counsel at another organization, but that's not necessarily true. It's generally true. That's such a lawyerly answer. It really does depend. Is the lawyer's answer to everything?
Well, I'm not asking for a general answer. What's a hypothetical?
Right. Well, that's what I'm getting to it.
Okay.
So, like, for example, I renegotiated our lease. All agreements that, you know, the organization has to deal with in order to keep its business going is the kind of thing that general counsel does.
And that's got to be boring, isn't it? Renegotiating a lease.
I don't think it's boring. Like, handling all the contracts that we
even do. The parts of it I was involved with were boring, about the stupid air conditioner that doesn't work right and all the stuff that we were dealing with that. That I dealt with that little part of it where it related to the technology needs here, and that was pretty boring.
You know, I didn't find that process boring, but I was just giving one example of a contract, you know, that is non-controversial. I don't have to say what it is. Yeah. You know, all the legal contracts, anything that the organization does, you know, handling. You know, as a legal services organization, we have to explore issues of attorney-client privilege or of conflict where we might be in a situation where, you know, two clients wind up adverse to each other, or where we might be in a situation where, you know, we have to be really careful about what kind of legal advice we can provide to whom or what we can say publicly. And those are issues that I get involved with and help decide policies for that. So that's, you know, that's sort of the general flavor of what the position is.
So why couldn't you get us free air conditioning on the weekends? Which was one of the things we were trying to get from the lease.
It wouldn't have been free.
Well, free isn't price anyway. Is our air conditioner free isn't freedom? I don't think there's any software in the actual air conditioning units. Although one of the air conditioning units I have has a remote control thing. So I guess there's probably software in that, but some sort of firmware, which I don't have the source code to, but I wouldn't even know how to upgrade.
Well, we do have some software that we use to monitor temperature when we turn on and off the machines.
That I actually use an IR blaster to turn on the secondary unit on and off. And the IR blaster is plugged into a USB port. And that's actually software that I wrote. There's free software for the IR blaster part of it, which is, it's a package in Debian, and I use that. And then I wrote just a little Perl script that turns it on and off.
I guess the lease was a bad example, but it's.
I'm sorry.
It's just sort of what came to mind as an easy thing to talk about.
But I'm not giving you a hard time about it, because in every building I ever worked in and had to deal with computers and cooling, there's always been problems of some sort, and the landlords never care.
Well, I mean, we did talk about that, and that was one of the reasons why we got a better deal overall. So we got something for it.
We just got cheaper rent because we have to deal with their stupid air conditioner.
More or less. There's, you know, we always have the ability to upgrade if we need to. This is really off topic.
Well, no, but we're exploring what general counsels deal with. Negotiating a lease was the example we picked.
And you know,
now we're talking about it.
Here's another example. Determining what we can do with the things that we have that's consistent with our nonprofit and tax exempt mission, which is something that's relevant for our clients too. All the free software nonprofit organizations have these same problems about what they can do with their equipment, and those kinds of policies are things that, you know, that a general counsel would be
involved. What do you mean, what you can do with your equipment?
So, like, you know, if you need to sell, you know, if you're deciding to sell some equipment that you have, or if you want to give a grant to an organization, or if you get a gift, you know, these kinds of issues are all, you know, they're all governed by our nonprofit rules at the state level and at the IRS rules on the federal level.
And we talked about the 501c3 requirements and so forth, and we talked about the Form 990 episode.
Yeah. No, and what the rules are.
So there's another thing you do. We had that episode talking about Form 990, and I do
the
Form 990.
Which we can link to in the show notes.
That's true. And I do with your help, of course, I did the Form 990 for Conservancy, but you handle, I don't touch the Form 990 for SFLC, nor do I want to, after having done the one for the Conservancy. So you do all the Form 990 work for SFLC.
Yeah, right? Well, and SFLC also winds up getting audited as well, because New York has rules about, you know, if you have a certain level of income, you have to have an independent audit.
So that's a New York rule, though.
That's a New York rule.
Yeah, but you do the Form 990, which is the federal filing.
A lot of nonprofits,
and
some other states have it as well. But the you know, more and more organizations are getting independent audits because, you know, donors want to see that. So
that's another thing you do.
That's another thing I do, although that's sort of in the treasurer angle more than general counsel. Although. Okay. Negotiating with the auditors about how much we're going to pay them and what terms they're going to do the audit, maybe using the general counsel land. Anyway, I'm just excited because I really feel lucky to work for SFLC, and being able to continue that kind of work.
And the council generally neat. On general issues.
I generally counsel on general issues, and you know what's bought and sold and produced, and you know what's produced.
So you really want sold. you want a job like that? That's weird.
I'm just kidding.
So there's the summary. We had a little hodgepodge of a show this time. We have a more single show topic on cue for.
I'm really excited
episode.
For that one. I guess we won't tease it.
Whatever you want to do, it's your show.
No, we'll just get to it. But
get to it.
What's get
that?
To it.
What does that
ready?
Mean? We'll just get to it.
We'll keep our eye on it.
We don't have to keep our eye on it. It hasn't been done yet.
You'll see it when you see it. But
well,
you're not seeing
see
it.
They won't see anything. We've already talked about this. We're not going to do video. They will hear it.
Yeah. And hopefully next week I will no longer have a cold.
It's not next week. It's 2 weeks. You still do this.
I still do it.
2 weeks. We decided an every 2 week schedule because we can't keep up with a one every week schedule.
It's true.
It's not possible.
But also,
we're not like the Linux Outlaws.
I don't know that our listeners want to listen to legal issues related to free software every week.
Probably they probably would. I don't know. Well, I don't know what these people want.
Well, some people we know want a 5 to 10 minute summary of the legal issues that we deal with in our podcast up front.
Yeah.
And others want...
Well, I was talking about this with actually Aaron, who folks heard on the last show, that there is this arc of podcasts where at some point in a podcast history, it becomes about the listener base they have and almost focused on inside jokes for those listeners. And podcasts, I think, actually become less accessible over time because they get a fan base and then the podcasters... talk to that fan base primarily, and there's all this back history, and it's hard to get new listeners. And I've seen this happen with multiple podcasts, and I don't know how, even knowing that that's a common thing that happens, I don't know how to prevent it or how to make sure that your podcast is still accessible to new listeners and so forth.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, for us, it's an issue of, you know, we don't want to be too repetitive about the issues that we're covering. Maybe we could go back to what we did at the beginning, which is give general introductions and tell people to skip the segment if they want to.
That's true. I don't know what they should do, but they should.
Well, let us know if you have any strong views on this.
And listeners. They can do that by writing to podcast@softwarefreedom.org for
we
feedback.
We always take donations at softwarefreedom.org.
How is donations giving us feedback?
Well, because if you like the show, you can give us a donation and let us know that that's
well,
why.
Well, we're asking for things people didn't like about the
I thought we were sort of wrapping up here.
We are. That's true. But okay. So #SFLC on Freenode is the IRC channel that I'm there, and Aaron's there most days, and Karen's almost never there. But
you say that so accusingly.
Well, you're not an IRC
accusatorily?
Person. I didn't used to. I wasn't an IRC person when I was.
I'm on IRC a lot of the time. I just don't hang out on those channels. I don't hang out on channels.
Why not?
Because.
Slash join. Is that too much to type? Slash join. Wow, pound SPLC.
This is brutal. No, it's not that.
You can't
it's
just add that the little auto join to.
No,
your
I find that I guess I worry that people are going to ask me. You know, blurt out legal questions that are better to ask
them. I just answer them by telling them the right to help at. So don't worry about that. I take all those and just say, you should write to help at.
I know, but sometimes what happens if people see you and they have something ongoing with you, they'll say, is there any, you know, do you have any thoughts on, you know, this happened, any thoughts on that? And then suddenly there's no longer attorney-client privilege and that's all waived.
Well, they know not to ask in a public channel, don't they?
I don't know. I think a lot of people don't think about it because they're used to talking publicly about everything they do.
Oh, you're just making excuses for not coming to my channel.
No, it's a really good, it's a good trait, I think. The instinct to talk publicly about things is something that I really admire. And
yeah, so you should get on and talk publicly about things with us.
But it's different when you have a lawyer's relationship.
But I don't know. You should try for a while, and if that happens, we will understand that you don't come back.
I'm almost always just lurking on Freenode.
Yeah, but
not in any
your
channel.
Username.
I know.
So, and I won't say it if you don't want me to say it. So. Okay.
So what?
So you won't come to the Pound SPLC. just say you won't, and we'll live with it.
Well, I haven't okay. been. So, you I know. I do once in a while if there's some reason.
Yeah, the reason is to be
and
there
I,
with
I join,
us every day.
I join certain projects channels when there's a discussion that I think I could weigh in on or okay. that it would be helpful to join or I'd like to listen to.
I'll start slash inviting you to Pound SPLC every day. And you get the little invite.
All right. I have no objection to that.
You're just going to ignore it, aren't you?
It's very easy to ignore.
She's going to slash ignore me on all of IRC now, and I'll never be able to talk to her again.
I don't think so. All right. Well,
2 weeks.
Thank you for joining us. The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license.
Hear the Linux Outlaws parodies at the end of last year?
Do you think that they didn't parody us because they were worried that we were going to parody them?
Well, we can.
Well, we'll keep an eye on it.
It's crap. Let's talk about games some more. Oh, no, that game's crap. Oh, it's proprietary software, but it's such a cool game. It's crap! It's crap!